And so, after Kipper the Cat comes Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, here, of course, on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. The archives of the shows are on SoundCloud or on our website, momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. And get in touch with me at rla@momentsunderlamplight.co.uk or lamplight@cambridge105.fm. We are the show that invites you to attend. Our show this evening is structured around our reading from Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, the 42nd chant or section of the poem. We'll go off on tangents as we proceed, looking at Greek myths, a Buddhist fable, the Book of Job, Dante's Inferno, and who knows what else, with music from old and new friends. So first, let's hear Whitman's passage and then take it from there. I am the teacher of athletes. He that by me spreads a wider breast than my own proves the width of my own. He most honors my style who learns under it to destroy the teacher. The boy I love, the same becomes a man not through derived power, but in his own right. Wicked rather than virtuous out of conformity or fear. Fond of his sweetheart, relishing well his stake, unrequited love or a slight, cutting him worse than a wound cuts. First rate to ride, to fight, to hit the bullseye, to sail a skiff, to sing a song or play on the banjo, preferring scars and faces pitted with smallpox over all latherers and those that keep out of the sun. I teach straying from me, yet who can stray from me? I follow you, whoever you are, from the present hour. My words itch at your ears till you understand them. I do not say these things for a dollar or to fill up the time while I wait for a boat. It is you talking just as much as myself. I act as the tongue of you. It was tied in your mouth. In mine, it begins to be loosened. I swear I will never mention love or death inside a house, and I swear I never will translate myself at all, only to him or her who privately stays with me in the open air. If you would understand me, go to the heights or water shore. The nearest gnat is an explanation, and a drop or the motion of waves a key. The maul, the oar, and the handsaw second my words. No shuttered room or school can commune with me, but roughs and little children better than they. The young mechanic is closest to me. He knows me pretty well. The woodman that takes his axe and jug with him shall take me with him all day. The farm boy ploughing in the field feels good to the sound of my voice. In vessels that sail, my words must sail. I go with fishermen and seamen and love them. My face rubs to the hunter's face when he lies down alone in his blanket. The driver, thinking of me, does not mind the jolt of his wagon. The young mother and old mother shall comprehend me. The girl and the wife rest the needle a moment and forget where they are. And they all would resume what I have told them.
I can see a swath of sinners sitting yonder, and they're acting like a pack of fools. Gazing into space, they let their minds wander instead of studying the good Lord's rules. You'd better pay attention, build your comprehension. There's going to be a quiz at your ascension, not to mention any threat of hell. But if you're smart, you'll learn your lessons well. Every bright description of the promised land mentioned could reach it if you keep alert. Learning every line to every last commandment may not help you, but it couldn't hurt. First you've got to read them, then you've got to heed them. You never know when you're going to need them. Just as only Elijah said to Jezebel, you better start to learn your lessons well.
Well, there's one response anyway to Whitman's lesson this week. Learn your lessons well from Godspell. With, of course, special fond salutes to Mary, Barry, Kevin, and all the other Rutgers preppies who put on the show for me way back in, well, just way back. The song tells us every bright description of the promised land mentions you can reach it if you keep alert. But that's not quite what Whitman is saying, is it? His poetry says something more like, in the very act of keeping alert, you are already in the promised land. I think he'd also say that you have already learned your lessons well. And he's here with his poem just to remind you of what you already know. That's the sense in which he is our teacher. It was a hard passage, I know, as I read it to you. But don't worry, I will go through it. And by the end of this session, you will understand a little more, anyway, of what Whitman's been talking about. See, he puts it very startlingly, I am the teacher of athletes. That's great, but what does he mean by this? What kind of athletes is he talking about? Well, I suppose these are athletes who, well, they're full of the joy of life, living fully in the body. Remember, Whitman has been celebrating all the parts of the body and all the bodily functions. I keep as delicate around the bowels as around the head and heart, he'd said. Copulation is no more rank to me than death is. I believe in the flesh and the appetites. The scent, he says, the scent of these armpits is aroma finer than prayer. Yes, you see, this is perhaps the kind of athletic enjoyment of the body that he's teaching us. But let's admit, too, that he's a teacher of spiritual athletes, teaching us to live fully in the spirit, opening up to every new experience, and every moment brings a new experience, and welcoming, without reservation, every different person around us in the world. And as we're coming near the end of this long poem, perhaps Whitman, our teacher, is asking us to pause a moment and ask ourselves, what has our experience of the poem taught us? What will we take away from it? How has the poem changed us? These are questions we ought to ask about, well, about any significant experience, especially experiences of great works of imagination. But they are questions I cannot answer for you, or as we heard Whitman tell us last time, I answer that I cannot answer. You must find out for yourself. So that's your homework. If I were giving you an exam on this poem, all the exam would ask you is to present your own meditation on what you learned from this teacher of athletes. How much more athletic are you now than you were before we began? But as it is, this exam question is merely optional. Send any answers you choose to submit to us at rla@momentsunderlamplight.co.uk or lamplight@cambridge105.fm. But I think more significant than the claim to be a teacher of athletes is Whitman's sense of his relationship with his students. He that by me spreads a wider breast than my own proves the width of my own. He most honors my style who learns under it to destroy the teacher. Let's attend to that for a moment. This student of his, this athlete, spreads his breast wide. That's not just a physical description of a muscle man in good shape for athletics, but think of the breast as our heart. Here's an athlete with a heart spread even wider than Whitman's. That's okay, Whitman says. That just proves the width of my own. When we say, wow, your breast is even wider than Whitman's, we are implying that we are already impressed by the width of Whitman's breast. Yes? Well, and how do you honor your teacher? By destroying the teacher. He most honors my style who learns under it to destroy the teacher. That's true education. A dynamic education does not leave us in the same place. We have to keep moving. That's why the examination system's method of just regurgitating what you've been taught is so unproductive. In fact, it's not education at all. At best, it's just training, going no deeper than your skills. In the Greek myths about the beginning of the world, we find Whitman's sentiment echoed. Uranus, the original sky god, was destroyed by his son, Cronus, or Saturn, who took a sharp blade and castrated his father, thereby destroying his power. And then Cronus' son, Zeus, battled against his father and defeated him and imprisoned him. Sure, we can read these myths as just bloodthirsty stories of power politics, but there is wisdom in them too. The new generation can find itself only by destroying what gave it birth. He most honors my style who learns under it to destroy the teacher. The myths illustrate it in such a violent way to impress on us the pain that usually accompanies this moment of independent growth. And then there's the story, I think it's a Zen story, about the disciple of a famous Zen master who is now ready to leave the master and go off on his own to solitary meditation so he can go deeper into the mystic truths the master has been teaching him. The Zen master blesses him on his journey and asks that the disciple send him a report every year on how he's getting on. And so, after a year, the master receives his first report from the disciple. "Oh, I have finally realized the unity of all beings," the note says. The teacher looks unimpressed and throws the paper away. A year goes by, and the next report arrives. "I know now that all things are unreal. Only unreality is real," the disciple writes. The teacher looks fed up and throws the paper away. A year goes by, and behold, no report arrives. I love the way in this story events stretch out over so many years, as though duration of time has nothing to do with the story, as of course it hasn't. Well, so yet another year goes by, and no report. Finally, the Zen master sends a letter to the disciple. "I have not heard from you for 2 years. I think you should let me know how you're doing." And in a short while, he gets a short note back from the disciple that merely says, "Who cares what you think?" At this, the Zen master's face lights up in joy. "He finally understood my teaching," he says.
Sleep now, take what you need, you think will last. But whatever you wish to keep, you'd better grab it fast. He understands you often with his gun. Crying like a fire in the sun. Look out, the saints are coming through. And it's all over now, baby blue. The highway is for gamblers. Better use your sense. Take what you have gathered from coincidence. The empty-handed painter from your streets is drawing crazy patterns on your sheets. sky too is folding over you. And it's all over now, baby blue. All your seasick sailors, they're all rowing home. All your reindeer armies, they're all going home. The lover who's just walked out your door has taken all his blankets from the floor. The carpet too is moving under you. And it's all over now, baby blue. Stepping stones behind, something calls for you. Forget the dead you've left, they will not follow you. The vagabond who's rapping at your door is standing in the clothes that you once wore. Strike another match, go start anew. And it's all over now, baby blue.
Bob Dylan's It's All Over Now, Baby Blue gives us another perspective on this practice of destroying your teacher. It's not at all clear what Baby Blue must leave now, but that just makes the song all the more universal, and it can apply just as richly to Whitman's line as to several other human situations. You must leave your teacher now, as well as so many other things. That, by the way, was the version from Dylan's Albert Hall performance in 1966. Whitman seems almost to make light of this, but as we've seen, it's not easy to destroy our teacher. In fact, it can often be the hardest, most painful episode in our life. Let us attend next to this interesting song about a son's struggles to destroy his mother's teachings. The song comes out of that world of confusion and contradiction that signals a true struggle to break free from the teacher and find a path of one's own, even though, so far, no such path is in sight. The song is called simply Mother. It's by the wonderful Louis Barabbas and the Bedlam Six, whom we've attended to before a few times on Evening Under Lamplight. I think the lyrics are not easy to grasp when you hear the song, and the lyrics are too important and too witty to be lost, so let me read them for you. I crumpled up the creeds of man and ran out into the rain, where I mourned for my lost virtue, but mourned more for what remained. I'd give my grief to God, but I'm just too proud to pray. Mother, Why did you raise me this way? I'm the busted bulb in your lighthouse. I'm the gilt dashed on your cliff. I read about perpetuity. I hope it's just a myth. Some people talk of progress, but all I see is decay. Mother, why did you raise me this way? I pin my hopes on the future like martyrs to a tree, but they haven't yet built the religion that can hold me. I hear tomorrow will be better. I heard the same thing yesterday. Mother, why did you raise me this way? Each night I go to sleep the way a Christian goes to lions. Feyzmir. Each night I go to sleep the way a Christian goes to lions. God can take my body. I'm leaving my soul to science. Catch that rhyme. Lions, science. I'm sure he had a plan in man, but something's gone aglay. Aglay? Has this man been reading Robert Burns? Mother, why did you raise me this way? There's a stranger in the mirror, or is it just stained glass? I've changed my face so many times, I wish I could change the past. There are more epithets than cigarettes stubbed out in my ashtray. Mother, why did you raise me this way? I'm a gentleman, a charlatan, prose from a poison pen. I lately made a big mistake, told the truth and sounded fake. My friends are all long gone. There's none left to betray. Mother, why did you raise me this way? I keep my guardian angel close, but always gagged and bound. Will someone please let me know the way off this misery go round? I long to see the spin on me in St. Peter's dossier. Mother, why did you raise me this way? I'm told there'd be no jobs until somebody dies, but a salary is just another word for consolation prize. So I'm plodding through perdition like some latter-day Dante. See, he even brings in our man Dante. Mother, why did you raise me this way? Now, I've told you all my thoughts, but I still haven't seen that penny. See, penny for your thoughts, get it? You asked me if there were bad times. Yeah, many. I long to say I love you, but it's such a damn cliché. Mother, why did you raise me this way?
I crumpled up the creeds of man, ran out into the rain. I mourn for my lost virtue, but mourn more for what remained. I give my grief to God, but I'm just too proud to pray. Mother, why did you raise me this way? I'm the busted bulb in your lighthouse, the gilt dashed in your cliff. I read about perpetuity, I hope it's just a myth. Some people talk of progress, but all I see is decay. Mother, why did you raise me this way? I pin my hopes in the future like martyrs to a tree. They haven't yet built the religion like me. Hold me, I hear tomorrow will be better. Heard the same thing yesterday. Mother, why did you raise me this way? Each night I go to sleep the way a Christian goes to lions. God can take my body, I'm leaving my soul to science. I'm sure he had a plan, man, but something's gonna delay. Mother, why did you raise me this way? Wish I could change the past. And I'm more epithets than cigarettes stuffed down in my ashtray. Mother, why did you raise me this way? I'm a gentleman, charlatan, rose my poison pen. Let me make a big mistake, told the truth inside of fate. Friends are all long gone, there's none left to betray. Mother, why did you raise me this way? Thank you.
Please let me know the way off this misery go round. I want to see the spin on me in St. Peter's dossier. Mother, why did you raise me this way? I'm told there'll be no jobs till somebody dies. But a salary is another word for consolation prize. So I'm nodding through perdition like some latter-day Dante. Mother, why did you raise me this way? Told you all my thoughts, but I still haven't seen that penny. You asked if there were bad times. Yeah, many. I long to say I love you. Such a damn cliche. Mother, why did you raise me this way? Mother, why did you raise me this way? Mother, why did you raise me this way?
Louis Barabbas and the Bedlam Six and Mother. I hope you noticed the witty trombone riffs by Biff Roxby, riffs by Biff. And here's what Louis Barabbas has written about this song. This song is not really an anthem to filial ingratitude. It's more the absurd mantra of a deeply deluded and lonely man, someone who thinks he's a Hamlet but is really a Rosencrantz. He's an individual of small and overlooked tragedies. Well, actually, I would disagree. Louis, with customary humility, wants to make this man insignificant. But in fact, he is the universal mythic hero fighting holdfast, fighting the bonds that hold him back. He's just the kind of athlete Whitman is trying to encourage. But back to Louis. I wrote Mother in March 2009. Actually, it pretty much wrote itself. I've always had a bad habit of overworking songs, like chipping away at a statue until it's nothing but dust. But Mother was different. The bulk of the writing happened between the hours of 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. one stormy night in Manchester. Well, my memory features a storm. This might be inaccurate, but it lends a certain gothic charm to the tale, with me playing the role of Dr. Frankenstein. There were originally a lot more verses than I then chiseled down to a still arguably self-indulgent 9. I made a decision at the time that I wasn't going to shy away from pretentiousness. If the lyrics were going to be the focus, then I was going to damn well enjoy them. I recall the first line was originally, "I wrestled with my religion." But I decided it was too much of a lazy cliché, and so beefed it up into the admittedly ridiculous, "I crumpled up the creeds of man," which is a line that I still relish singing to this day. I still regret that this song didn't pique the interest of Radio 4's Jenny Murray. When we released the single version back in 2010, the press release was fashioned with the sole purpose of getting the song played on Woman's Hour. It even mentioned Volumnia from Coriolanus. Actually, come to think of it, that might be one of the reasons why the media didn't take us seriously. Thanks, Mother. By the way, Louis Barabbas is coming to Cambridge on 25th of March, Good Friday, in fact, as part of his solo album tour, playing at Hot Numbers, just down the street from the Cambridge 105 studios here on Guider Street. The performance starts at 7:30 and admission is technically free, with a suggested donation of £5 or more if you want. We'll say more about this gig closer to the time. Oh, and by the way, in case you were wondering, you are attending, and attending too, I hope, Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 with Robert Louis Abrahamson. And now, step with me back to our lines from Walt Whitman. Whitman Whitman's next line also invites us to attend a little closer. The boy I love, the same becomes a man, not through derived power, but in his own right. Here's another important distinction. We mature not through derived power, but in our own right. Perhaps the sequence Whitman sets out goes a little like this. The boy I love, first we must notice the child, the boy or the girl, and love that child and allow that child to experience at least a few drops of unconditional love for the child's own self. Not the Santa Claus myth that I'll love you only if you've been good, but the divine, or shall we say the Whitman-esque, love of you just for who you are, not tempered by what you do. Once the child has the experience of this, the child will have a sense of his or her own right, that deeper self within, and the child will know that developing this identity is what true maturity consists of. As Ralph Waldo Emerson had said a few years before Whitman was writing, and he was one of the main inspirations for Whitman, we must strive to develop our own truths, not just accept the ones we've been taught. In these famous words, Emerson declared, "Why should not we also enjoy an original relation to the universe? Why should not we have a poetry and philosophy of insight and not of tradition? And a religion by revelation to us, and not the history of previous generations." Here is the noblest aspect of the American dream, American individualism, rejecting derived power, claiming his own right to be his own man. But this can be achieved only, as we have heard Joseph Campbell telling us in other episodes, only by following our own bliss, that is, following those expansive impulses within us. Much of American individualism today, and you know what that's about, seems to be merely boys, usually boys, but ladettes too, parading ignorant slogans, demanding to do things their own way, which actually turns out to be either based on unexamined fear of anything or anyone different, or else, what is worse, it's based on the blind echoing of some demagogic hype trumped up to intoxicate them. They shout their rage in the name of individualism and democracy. But let them study Walt Whitman a little, or Emerson, or even, God forbid, the Bible, and learn to mature a little. There, so much for my quasi-political rant this week. Back to Whitman, so we at least can learn to mature. And next for our attention comes this amazing line. Wicked, rather than virtuous out of conformity or fear. Whitman is saying that his athlete would rather be wicked than virtuous out of conformity or fear. He's saying that it's better to choose wickedness if that choice comes from deep within you than to be virtuous if that virtue is only blindly copying the rules others have set out for us and that we follow just out of conformity. To look good, or just because we can't be bothered to work out virtue for ourselves, or maybe even out of some kind of fear that if we don't conform to what we're told to do, we'll be punished in some way. These are the people, to take an easy example, who keep themselves pure before marriage because they've been told that premarital sex is a sin and they'll go to hell for it. They conform out of the fear of hellfire, without any idea of what that myth of hellfire is really about. It's better to be wicked and have sex, Whitman says, if this arises out of a true passion within. On the other hand, there's also the person who consents to sex in order to conform to social expectations and peer pressure, out of fear that he or she will not be liked. It's better, Whitman would say, to just say no and be considered wicked or at least uncool. At least you are your own person. Well, here's a more complex example, straight from the Bible, folks. Do you remember Job? A very virtuous man. As we learn from the first chapter of the book of Job, the most difficult book in the Bible, Job is perfect and upright, and one that feared God and eschewed evil. He performs all the required sacrifices, not just for himself, but for his children as well, just in case they forgot to do their own sacrifices properly, or just in case they haven't been living the kind of perfect life Job is living. Very nice. But Job is just conforming to the teachings he's been given. And as we discover, he is virtuous basically out of fear. He's afraid of life, and he treats his religion like an insurance policy. If he carries out all the practices he's been told to carry out, then he will be virtuous and God will like him and give him a good life. 1, 2, 3. Job is about to learn, however, that there's a lot more to it than this. He'll learn that we do not act virtuously in order that God should love us, but that because God loves us, then we desire to act virtually so we can be closer to this love. And here's another example. The image of the whited sepulchre, which Jesus applies to the scribes and Pharisees, those people who do everything the law prescribes and make sure they criticize anyone who doesn't do these things. But this is just outward conformity. They are blind guides and are like unto whited sepulchres, that is, the richly carved marble tombs of important people, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. Jesus is tough, you see. Tough about what matters.
Straight from the shoulder, I think like a soldier. I know what's right and what's wrong.
He knows what's right and what's wrong.
The original discriminating buffalo man, and I'll do what's wrong as long as I can.
He'll do what's wrong as long as he can.
I live in a labyrinth under the sea, down in the dark as can be. I like the dark as can be.
He likes the dark as can be.
Attack you or eat you a whole. Down in the dark, my bone mills a roll. Porridge for my porridge bowl.
Porridge for his porridge bowl.
I'm strong as the earth from which I'm born.
He's strong as the earth from which he's born.
I can't dream well because of my own.
He can't dream well because of his horns.
I'm strong as the earth from which I'm born.
He's strong as the earth from which he's born.
I can't dream well because of my horns.
He can't dream well.
Aggressively reliable, bull, bull. Strong as the earth from which I'm born.
Strong as the earth from which he's born.
I can't dream well because of my horns.
He can't dream well because of his horns.
I'm the original discriminating buffalo man. Wrong as long as I can.
He'll do what's wrong as long as he can.
And that was the Incredible String Band and the Minotaur's song. The Minotaur, of course, is not a full human being, but only half human and half bull, for very interesting reasons which we won't go into right now. It's his bull-headed nature to latch onto something, whatever social conventions and political opinions he's been taught are right, and never to deviate, straight from the shoulder, as his cliché tells him. This is the kind of immature person Whitman's been talking about, too. He's not wicked, just wrong. And he'll do what's wrong as long as he can, as he lives in his benighted world, as dark can be. But now, perhaps, Whitman's line, wicked rather than virtuous out of conformity or fear, reminds me most of a moment early in Dante's Inferno, when Dante has his first encounter with an area of the underworld. Let's not call it hell. This area is only the vestibule or threshold of hell. It's entirely different from hell itself. Let me explain. Hell is the place where ruined souls are sent because they turned their back to the truth and chose to live instead in a kind of fantasy world, the fantasy that they are the center of the world and everything revolves around them. Living in this fantasy, self-centered existence, out of touch with the facts of the world, these souls have lost their mind, lost, as Dante says, il ben dell'intelletto, the good of their intellect. Where else can they go than into the universal dustbin called hell? But before Dante gets to these damned souls, he passes through the vestibule, where he finds innumerable souls, visualized as naked bodies, rushing around a huge plain, constantly stung by wasps and hornets to keep them moving, forming various different groups, each one following a leader holding up a pennant, a kind of mockery of those people who march behind a flag to support some cause. These are the pusillanimi, the cowards who played it safe in life by never making any choices. And Dante is amazed at how many souls are here. More souls right here than Dante thought had ever died throughout all history. E non avrei creduto che morte tanta n'avesse disfatta, he says. I should never have thought that death could ever have unmade so many. Usually this category of pusillanimy refers to those who never took sides, which is why, here in the afterlife, they partake in a mockery of taking sides behind empty flags. They are the couch potatoes, the kind of people we today tell to get a life, that is to say, most people throughout history, completely wasted lives. But I want to suggest that also in this category are those who Whitman says are virtuous out of conformity or fear. They are afraid of venturing on their own perpetual journey, as we spoke about last time, and so they take refuge in conforming to the external laws and to the social mores. Okay, got it? But there's a slight twist to this too. These souls cannot be condemned to hell. They did not choose to turn from the truth, and in Dante's mind this makes them even more despicable than those who actually sinned. They obviously cannot go to heaven, since they did not choose the truth, but, and here's the interesting point, they cannot be placed in hell either, since if the wicked souls saw them, the wicked souls would feel superior and look down on these coward souls who didn't even dare to live a full life. And we can't have these damned souls feeling superior to anyone else. So the conformists have their own spot, a nowhere spot. Virgil tells Dante not to bother spending any time talking to any of these. They're not worth it. Can you see how Dante's little scheme prefigures Whitman's statement that it's better to choose wickedness than to be afraid to choose anything at all? Wicked rather than virtuous out of conformity or fear. Better to be in hell than to conform with the crowd all running wildly after some meaningless flag.
stand alone or with somebody else. I'll stand with all of us together. If you can believe in something bigger than yourself, you can follow the flag forever. They say it's just a dream, some dreamer's dream, that it's an empty thing that really has no meaning. They say it's all a lie, but it's not a lie. I'm going to follow the flag till I die. Into every life a little rain must fall, but it's not gonna rain fail. You can rise above, you can rise above it all. We will follow the flag together. We will follow the flag.
You recognized the distinctive voice of Randy Newman, didn't you? And you could guess the title of the song is Follow the Flag. It's from his Land of Dreams album. Is Randy seriously telling us just to follow the flag? No, he is, as usual, ironic, in a complex way that literal listeners will never get. You can stand alone, he says, apparently completely earnest, or with somebody else, or stand with all of us together. That sounds good. A rugged individual, or a couple, or a community of fellow believers? But suspend your approval until you hear more. If you can believe in something bigger than yourself, you can follow the flag forever. But what if this something bigger than yourself is just a larger ego, a tribal ego? We have to ask what this something bigger than yourself is doing. If it's just setting itself up in opposition to some enemy it demonizes for being different, there's no virtue in joining this group, except, of course, being virtuous out of conformity or fear. But joining the group can give the illusion of safety. Into every life a little rain must fall, says this flag follower. But following the flag allows us to rise above it all. The flag, it turns out, functions as an opiate. While all this time, on the mythic level, you're being stung by wasps and hornets, all those stings of fear to keep you moving in blind hurry along with the other blind and featureless wasted souls behind empty flags. Thanks, Randy Newman. Thanks to, of course, Dante Alighieri. Well, next, Whitman gives us a short list of the characteristics of his athlete, who seems to combine tenderness, fond of his sweetheart, with tough guy habits, relishing well his steak. He seems to be both sensitive and adventuresome. Fond of his sweetheart, relishing well his steak, unrequited love or a slight cutting him worse than a wound cuts. First rate to ride, to fight, to hit the bullseye, to sail a skiff, to sing a song or play on the banjo. He has closer affinity with those who have scarred faces or faces pockmarked from the smallpox than with what Whitman calls latherers, presumably those respectable men who lather up and shave their face every day, and with those that keep out of the sun, that is, the dainty ladies who want to preserve their aristocratic pale complexions. Whited sepulchres of a different sort. Whitman had told us that his students should destroy their teachers, but now he says that actually they can never get rid of the teacher's influence, which is always with them. I teach straying from me, yet who can stray from me, he says. I follow you wherever you are, from the present hour. And he doesn't just tag along with you all the time. His words, he says, itch at your ears till you understand them. That is, his words will keep coming back to you over and over until someday you might finally see even just a little bit of what he's talking about. Maybe you'll be looking at the politicians in their dark suits up on the television screen and suddenly notice that they are all immaculately clean-shaven. And then perhaps remember Whitman's Latherers and realize how far you are from these respectable people and how much closer to even the scruffiest person you pass on the street. In fact, the whole point of Whitman's talking here, as he does, is not so he can make some money from his book, and not so he can pass the time while he has nothing better to do. No, in fact, it's not even Whitman talking. It is you talking just as much as myself, he says. I act as the tongue of you. So these have actually been our own words all along. So closely are we all tied together by our common humanity. Your tongue was tied in your mouth, Whitman says. In mine, it began to be loosened. Well, after all, we've known all along, deep down, I mean, we've known that education does not really consist in mindless repetition, but in moving on from your teacher on your own path. We've known that we mature not by taking on the power from the older generation and just perpetuating what they've been doing, but by allowing our own identity to blossom into what it was created to become. We've known this, but for some reason we've forgotten it or haven't been able to find the right way to express it. So here's Whitman acting as our tongue. Our tongue was tied. We didn't know how to express these truths we felt deep down. So Whitman gives us the words we need, and giving us the words brings these deep truths up to consciousness for us. And the section ends with an affirmation of the healthy, athletic characteristics of Whitman and of all those his words have reached. A healthy love for the fresh outdoors rather than the stuffy rooms inside. And healthy activities, actually doing things that require skill and craft. Here's his conclusion. I swear I will never mention love or death inside a house, and I swear I never will translate myself at all, only to him or her who privately stays with me in the open air. If you would understand me, go to the heights or water shore. The nearest gnat is an explanation and a drop or the motion of waves a key. The maul, the oar, and the handsaw second my words. No shuttered room or school can commune with me, but roughs and little children better than they. The young mechanic is closest to me. He knows me pretty well. The woodman that takes his axe and jug with him shall take me with him all day. The farm boy ploughing in the field feels good at the sound of my voice. In vessels that sail, my words must sail. I go with fishermen and seamen and love them. My face rubs to the hunter's face when he lies down alone in his blanket. The driver, thinking of me, does not mind the jolt of his wagon. The young mother or old mother shall comprehend me. The girl and the wife rest the needle a moment and forget where they are. They and all would resume what I have told them. Let's stop right there. I just wanted to see how Sly and the Family Stone's everyday people resonated with Whitman. It's schoolyard slogans and taunts and 60s cliches like figuring out the bag I'm in, not to mention the need to to fill in gaps with the meaningless and so on and so on and Scooby-Dooby-Doo. All this makes for a pretty thin song, don't you think? And yet, Sly did come up with a lovely slogan in Different Strokes for Different Folks, a perfect slogan as far as slogans go. And more than anything, I just feel the energy here. I hadn't listened to the song for ages, and as soon as it started, I was immediately swept by its joyful pace, just right for one of Whitman's athletes. And so on and so on, and now we've come to the end of this evening's Evening Under Lamplight with Robert Louis Abrahamson on Cambridge 105. Get in touch at rla@momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. Find the archives at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk and come back in a fortnight to find out where we go next.